It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert. Rob Ferret will be back on Monday. Happy New Year. Well, we all have aspirations for 2014. Some of us make resolutions. Others of us set goals. It's a fresh start, even for institutions like Congress and the Wisconsin State Legislature. On this first day of 2014, we thought we'd check in with the political scientists about what we might expect from our federal and state government this year, what stories we should look for, and his predictions for the biggest issues in the coming year. Tim Dale is with us. He's an assistant professor of political science at UW-La Crosse. Tim, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
Well, first, let's zoom in on Congress. What big stories do you see coming out of Congress in 2014?
Well, Congress is following up on a tumultuous year with the government shutdown, divided government that a lot of us were following in the past year. I think a lot of people will be watching Congress to see how the two parties work together. And there's also the question about how the Republican Party might come together. There's actually as much division within the Republican Party right now as there is between the Republicans and the Democrats. And so I think there's going to be some soul searching to figure out the direction of the party. And we'll be watching pretty closely the House of Representatives to see how that alignment might take place.
And I'm assuming that just about everyone would like to see Congress playing nicely, working better together. What do you think will decide whether or not it actually happens?
Well, and that's actually a really interesting part of the way that our Congress works, is that as much as everyone says they want Congress to play nice together and work together, the members of Congress serve districts where they're the only representative from that district. And when they go back to their district, the people in the district tell them that they want them to fight for what they elect them to fight for. So as much as in general we want Congress to work together, specifically when members run for election, they promise that they will fight for certain things. And that fight means that there is usually some sort of fight in Congress. And so the only way that Congress will actually work together is if they perceive constituents demanding that they work together. So if members go back to their districts and hear from people that they want them to work for compromise as opposed to stand for certain things or for certain principles in an uncompromising way, then I think that will really be the only realistic way that we would get Congress with an air of cooperation.
So it sounds like there's built-in contradictions there, whether we want a scrappy representation or whether we actually seriously do want compromise.
Yeah, that's definitely true. And even in the idea of compromise is something that is appealing to people. But then when they're asked about issues that they care about, they tend to say that they want a representative who's uncompromising on those issues. And the problem is that if you get enough people who elect a representative with enough issues that they want to be uncompromising about, then as much as we might like the idea of compromise, we really actually don't elect representatives with the mindset that they will be compromising. So it really is a contradiction that's built into why we see Congress functioning the way it does most of the time.
Well, on another note, we have a midterm election coming up in November. How do you think the election will affect national politics in the coming year?
Yeah, that is going to be something that we'll be watching very closely. The 2014 midterm election will be all of the members of the House of Representatives will be up for re-election. One-third of the Senate will be up for re-election. And there's even a chance that we may get a new Speaker of the House elected, either if the Democrats take over or if the Republicans stay in power. John Boehner may be done as Speaker. And so I think that the direction of the parties will be affected. And as we've seen this past year, the House of Representatives has quite a bit of power when it comes to the funding of government and the working of government. And so I think that we will see some really important developments in the coming year in terms of how Congress is going to be composed and then what Congress will be doing. And we're going to be hearing from the representatives as they run for election or reelection in terms of the vision that they have for Congress.
So you think there's a chance for a major shakeup in the composition of Congress?
There's a chance, but even as Congress has record-breaking low approval ratings, the individual members of Congress back in their districts enjoy a pretty high approval rating. So this is one of the contradictions with the way that we elect our national government, is that even if Congress has an 8 or 9% approval rating, what really matters in the number to look at is the approval rating of individual members in their districts. And so as long as individual members in their districts are enjoying a 50% or higher approval rating, as much as people hate Congress, it really wouldn't make as much difference. The chance that there is a shakeup, though, is if people have been really disgusted with their particular members of Congress. So there aren't a lot of opinion polls that are out right now, and as we get closer to the election, this will be something to watch to see if people are really upset at their own members for their lack of compromise or inability to work together, as opposed to just being overall disgruntled with what Congress and the national government is doing.
Do you think it could be that the midterms end up being more of a referendum on the Affordable Care Act than anything else?
It could be. I think that the Affordable Care Act is going to be an important part of the debate. And I think for Democrats, there's going to be, particularly for the Obama administration, a real effort to try to get some of the problems cleaned up and the public perception improved on that. But I think it goes deeper than that. I think one of the things that we haven't heard people talk about as much or complain about as much recently is when people complain sometimes that there isn't a difference between the two major political parties. I think right now in this moment of history, we see a real difference between the two political parties, and in particular what each's view of government should be or what government should do. And I think the Affordable Care Act is representative of the view of government that Democrats take, and I think Republicans have a real difference with that. So at the heart of this is going to be a referendum on the Affordable Care Act, but it'll also be an overall discussion about the direction of where government should go and what the responsibility of government should be.
Now, you said there was some schism within the Republican Party itself, and that one of the things that you'd be watching for was how that would play out down the line. And I guess I'm wondering, you know, do you think that 2014 will be a year of soul searching for the Republican Party? Now, that's exactly what people said the last time around when there was a major presidential race as well. But do you see that continuing to evolve as we move along?
I think it's continuing to evolve. I think we've seen some new players on the stage with Senator Ted Cruz. I think that there are going to be Republicans who are making it increasingly clear that they're interested in running for president. And I think the recent government shutdown, we had a very public kind of struggle within the Republican Party about whether or not there should be some sort of compromise or whether or not there's a willingness to even have government shut down in order to stand for certain principles. So I think that's really where the soul searching will be, is the Republican Party, does it want to be a big tent party where as many people as possible could come in and be interested in compromise? Or do they think that they can win elections, sticking with principles, being the party of less government, even to the point of willingness to have government shut down?
What about the area of being centrist versus, you know, moving farther in one direction or the other?
Yeah, that definitely has something to do with it. Whenever there's a national election, particularly when it comes to a presidential election, the party that's the most successful is typically the party that appeals to the broadest base of support. So each party usually has about 30% of the population that they can count on, which leaves another 40% of the population who identify either independent or only slightly lean in one direction or the other. And so when a party is interested in winning more votes nationally, typically you'll see a move toward the center. But there are different views on how a person or a party or a candidate can capture some of those 40% of voters. And this is really where the argument will be. There are also people in the party who say that it's more important to stand for a principle than it is even to win elections. And this is where you get some of the debates on the Republican side, where there are people who are complaining about Mitt Romney as a candidate or if Chris Christie is going to be a candidate. Whether or not those candidates are acceptable for people who want the Republican Party to stand for certain things. And so this is the kind of debate that's going to happen, particularly on the Republican side, going into the next election cycle.
Now, I'm guessing another safe bet is that we're going to be watching the economy quite closely, just like we have been this past year. Now, with the closing of 2013, there did seem to be some positive economic indicators. How important do you think the economy will be in the political scene come 2014?
Yeah, well, it's going to be very important. And I think one of the interesting things about the elections that we're going to see coming up is that we've had a national government, or at least in the presidency, the Democrats in charge. In the state, we've had Republicans in charge. And so there's going to be a competition for who's going to claim the most credit for economic recovery or blame for a slower than expected economic recovery in other areas. I think that the economy is a really important factor. And this is also because people have been looking at the economy as a primary issue, and all of the issues that are related to the economy, job creation and deficits, these are all things that are going to be central to these campaigns.
Now, let's say the economy takes off and it looks like we are on solid ground finally. We have jobs, we have construction, all those things that people look to. What does that mean for the two political parties?
Typically, when the economy is improving, incumbents do well. So if the economy is improving nationally, I think Democrats probably will get more credit for that. And in the state, if the economy improves, Republicans will get more credit for that. And it may or may not have anything to do with policies at either level, or maybe it has somewhat to do with policies at both levels. But any party or person who's in power typically has a reward when the economy does well. And typically, if the economy is doing poorly, the party or representative that is currently in office would get punished.
We're talking right now to political scientist Tim Dale about his predictions for the biggest stories expected in national and state politics in 2014. Coming up, we'll talk about what Tim thinks the top stories will be in Wisconsin for the coming year. And we'd love to hear from you on this, too. What do you think the biggest stories of 2014 will be, and what issues would you like to see the federal government tackle? What do you hope for from Congress? Do you want to see more cooperation, or do you want to see your representatives standing up for what you would like the big issues to be? Do you want to see them be scrappy? And what about the state of Wisconsin? What emerging headlines do you see as the big stories likely to make the news? You can reach us at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. Or you can email us at talk@wpr.org. And we're picking up our conversation now with political scientist Tim Dale about his predictions for the biggest stories for state and national government in 2014. And we're taking your calls. What do you think the biggest stories of 2014 will be on both the national stage and the Wisconsin stage? And what do you think will emerge as we move out of some big areas of contention? We had the government shutdown. We had a lot of partisan gridlock going on. And of course, we have the gubernatorial race coming up in Wisconsin. What do you think the big stories will be, and what would you like them to be? You can call us at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. Or send your email to talk@wpr.org. Now, earlier we talked about the big stories you were expecting on the national stage. Now, let's talk explicitly here about Wisconsin in 2014. What big stories do you see emerging here?
Well, in Wisconsin, the big headline is going to be the governor's race, as you just mentioned. And not only is it going to have attention in the state, but also outside of the state. Scott Walker is a notable governor in being one of the Republicans who took over a state back 4 years ago, and of course we had the recall attempt, controversies involving state policies, state budgets. So in this year we are going to get, while the recall was a kind of referendum on Walker's term, we have the first full referendum on Walker's leadership. And with the Republicans in control of the state legislature, unlike the national government where we have a divided government, we do not have that situation in the state. And so the Republicans are going to be treating this election and the Democrats as a question about the Walker governorship and also the state legislature. So that really will be the story of 2014.
Is this a big wild card? You talked about the recall elections. Is it fair to say that the recall election was also a referendum on recall elections?
Yeah, what we saw with the recall election is that there were clearly people who supported Walker and clearly people who didn't like what Walker had done. But the exit poll showed that some of the people who voted for Walker were people who did not like the idea of a recall election. That is, that there are people who believe that Walker should be allowed to fulfill an entire term in office and then be held accountable for that term. And so I think you're right. I think part of the reason that the recall was so successful and so many votes were in Walker's column is because the idea of a recall did not sit well with some people. And so with the election of 2014, we're going to get the, so to speak, real election for governor. And without the politics of the recall itself, it'll be a more clear picture and depiction of what voters think about Walker as governor, as opposed to just an opinion about a recall.
how much national attention do you think the election's going to get?
Well, I think that there will be quite a bit of national attention for a couple of reasons. The first is that Walker represents a Republican governor who took over a state, and this has happened in other states around the country. And really, one of the best examples, most clear examples of policies being put into place that the Republicans really think are the best policies for state budgeting, policy priorities. And so I think that there's a policy reason why a lot of people will be looking at Wisconsin. Do these policies work? Do voters think that they'll work? The other reason that a lot of people will be watching is because of the personalities who are involved, in particular Scott Walker, who by some accounts is interested in running for president. And even if he has not indicated that he's interested, there are some Republicans who are interested in Scott Walker running for president. So I think that there are some policy issues, but also some national implications for the success or failure that Walker might have in the election in 2014, kind of setting the stage for the next 3 years of national politics.
With the gubernatorial race here to egg citizens on, do you think that what will happen is that it will reveal itself that Wisconsin is sort of over the recall elections, over all of the animosity that went on here on both sides, or do you think that we'll be sort of returned to that same sort of atmosphere again?
Well, I think that we'll return to that atmosphere at least a little bit, because I think if there's one thing that the recall election showed is that people feel fairly strongly about their policy positions on these issues. And so division, even though it expresses a disagreement and discord, it also shows that people are really invested in politics, really care about the outcome of elections. I'm not sure that we're going to see the protests that we saw around the recall election, but I imagine that we're going to see some pretty strong feelings and some people who have had a chance to think a little bit more about the way that they make arguments publicly, the way that they express their position, and we're going to see some real attempts at trying to convince maybe swing voters that the policies either work or don't work.
Now, we should talk about the Democratic challengers. Mary Burke has already thrown her hand into the ring as a Democratic candidate. What do we need to know about her for 2014?
Well, Burke is the person that many Democrats are considering to be the person who is the apparent challenger to Walker. There are a couple other candidates who may become involved in the race. I think right now the money is going to Burke, and even the money against the Democrats is going against Burke. So they're already very seeing some ads against Burke, some websites that have been designed as attack websites. So I think in Burke, the Democrats think that they have a person who comes from kind of relatively outside of politics, from the business world, who will be able to speak directly to the issues that they think that they might be able to gain some headway against Walker on.
So is it possible that with Mary Burke in place, there won't even be a Democratic primary? Do you see that happening?
It's possible. Right now, other candidates who may be interested are probably looking at the ability to raise money. Typically, if there is a candidate who emerges early as kind of the apparent challenger, it's very difficult to gain support for an opposition candidate. The reason that we might see an opposition candidate, and this is just historically not necessarily in this situation, is when there are major issues that are dividing a party, and the major issues that may cause one candidate to stand for something that other members of the party don't. I don't think that's the case here. I think the major issue for the Democrats right now is to beat Scott Walker. I don't think there's a lot of division within the party on policy issues. And so that would be a reason that we might predict that there wouldn't be a Democratic challenger. But that being said, I know that there are some Democrats who are considering it. And if there's enough people telling them that they should run, we may see a challenge, even if it's not successful.
And as a final question here, do you think Wisconsin is still suffering from election fatigue, or do you expect a big turnout at the polls?
That one's hard to say, because we really haven't seen the kind of election fervor that we've seen over the last few years in Wisconsin. But I think that there are enough people who care deeply about the issues that I think that we would predict a pretty good turnout in the governor's race. And even with the recall, I think there's a chance that we might see a higher turnout given as much attention as this election is going to garner in 2014.
Okay, well, Tim, thank you so much for joining us, and Happy New Year. Thanks for making time today.
Thanks for having me. Happy New Year.
That was Tim Dale, Assistant Professor of Political Science at UW-La Crosse. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert. Thanks for joining us on this first day of the new year. And with the new year comes New Year's resolutions. And for lots of us, that means a renewed focus on our health. But does anyone really resolve to improve their digestive health? Well, back in November, we spoke with Dr. Robin Chutkin. She's a gastroenterologist and the author of the book Gut Bliss. And she says the ticket to better health begins with your digestive system. I began the interview by asking her if she thought that the field of digestive health has sort of been ignored by the general public.
Absolutely. You know, Hippocrates said, long before I said it, that all disease begins in the gut. And he actually was right. The GI tract is sort of the central wheel, and the different parts of the body are the spokes that come off it. And if from a digestive point of view, all is not well in your digestive tract, it's really hard for the rest of you to feel well. Bloating is something that's been ignored for a long time because it's something that women often complain of and doctors think it's not serious, but it can be a real sign that all is not well in your digestive tract, and it's definitely worth paying attention to.
Well, what kinds of symptoms should we be worried about?
Well, bloating on its own is generally more of a nuisance symptom than a sign of something serious, but in association with other symptoms, it actually can be a signal that there is something very serious going on. For example, ovarian cancer, it's often called a silent killer, but what we realize now is that persistent bloating can be a major sign of ovarian cancer and something that shouldn't be ignored, particularly if it's associated with abdominal pain or weight loss. Same for some more other worrisome diagnoses. So, for example, colon cancer can cause bloating, usually with associated rectal bleeding, some other conditions like Crohn's disease, which is an autoimmune condition. So bloating on its own is not necessarily worrisome, but in conjunction with things like blood in the stool or bleeding in between your menstrual cycle, significant weight loss, more than 10% of your body weight without trying, abdominal pain, these are the sorts of things that should make you seek medical attention for your bloating.
So those are some of the more serious things. On the other hand, it sounds like there are symptoms that we experience when things just are not functioning the way that they should with our digestive health. We could be feeling better. We could be digesting better, but we're not. What are some of the things in terms of the non-scary disease realm that we can do for everyday health?
So, Veronica, there's a couple big categories here, and the food is a huge one. So lactose intolerance, for example, more than 50% of the world's population is lactose intolerant and can't digest dairy. And that might be you. Lots of people eat dairy every day, not necessarily drinking milk, but eating yogurt or cheese, and they feel kind of bloated and uncomfortable every day, and they don't really put the two together. My book has a 10-day plan. It's really a simple elimination diet, and I ask people to get rid of the 6 most common foods associated with bloating, and it very conveniently spells out SAD gas. So the SAD part is soy, artificial sweeteners, and dairy, and the gas part, gluten, alcohol, and sugar. Soy bloats you because if you eat enough processed soy, it can have estrogen-like effects, causing you to retain water. Artificial sweeteners aren't absorbed in the small intestine. That's why they don't contribute any calories, but they get fermented by bacteria in the large intestine, and they produce a lot of gas that can really bloat you. And then dairy, we talked about, lots of people are lactose intolerant and don't realize it. The gas part can be challenging, the gluten, alcohol, and sugar. Of course, it's a relatively small number of Americans who have celiac disease, which is an actual allergy to gluten, the protein in wheat, rye, and barley. But millions more are gluten intolerant and have bloating and other symptoms, fatigue, sometimes brain fog from gluten. Alcohol in moderation, most people tolerate pretty well, but alcohol can really irritate the lining of the GI tract, and it also decreases production of digestive enzymes that help you break down food. And of course, it just can add calories and inches to your waistline. And then sugar, this is a really tough one, so for most people to give up, or at least to cut down on significantly. When you eat a lot of sugary food, you end up feeding the wrong kind of bacteria in your gut. And you end up with overgrowth of yeast species and some not-so-friendly bacteria that end up producing a lot of gas and bloating you. So what I recommend is eliminating SAD gas, these 6 foods, for 10 days. You'll probably feel a lot better, but if you decide, gosh, there's something I'm really missing and I'm not sure it was really that, I recommend reintroducing one category at a time, sort of a week at a time. If you eliminate sad gas and you feel great and then you go out and have a bagel and all of a sudden you're massively bloated and uncomfortable, that might help you figure out that gluten is a culprit. And you don't necessarily need to avoid it 100% if you don't have celiac disease, but maybe 80% of the time.
Now, in terms of probiotics, that's something that we hear a lot about today. We didn't maybe 10, 15 years ago, but these days, probiotics, the bacteria in the gut, are linked to things like brain health and being able to be resistant to depression. How much do probiotics matter and good bacteria in the gut?
So, Veronica, the microbiome, the billions and trillions of bacteria in your digestive system that make up the microbiome, are an absolutely fascinating area, because what we're realizing is that what you can't see, the gut bacteria, may be more important than what you can. They're incredibly important, not just for the health of the digestive lining, which will determine how well you absorb stuff and whether you have gas or not, but for your immune system. So what we're finding is that kids who are given frequent antibiotics in childhood often will develop autoimmune diseases like asthma and certain allergies like Crohn's, lupus, even diabetes later in life. The Italians are actually quite far ahead of us in the gut bacteria research. And one Italian researcher in particular, Dr. Leonetti in Florence, he did a fascinating study where he looked at the gut bacteria of kids in Florence eating a standard, sort of typical Western diet, high in sugar, fat, and meat. And he looked at a group of kids in Burkina Faso eating a mostly plant-based diet with legumes and the occasional termite. And he found that the gut bacteria at birth in both sets of kids were virtually identical. But as soon as the kids migrated to table food, the gut bacteria changed dramatically. The kids in Florence eating the Western diet had less species diversity. So in other words, they had fewer types of bacteria, which is a real problem. It turns out bacterial diversity is really important. And they had more species associated with obesity, inflammatory bowel disease, allergies, and autoimmune diseases. The Burkina Faso kids eating the very unprocessed plant-based diet had species associated with leanness and with less disease. Now, if we take a step forward, what people have sort of put together is like, well, even if you're eating a not-so-great Western diet, we'll just give you back some bacteria. And so a probiotic might seem like a great idea. The problem is we've only isolated several hundred species of gut bacteria. And of that number, we can only culture and grow just a handful of them outside of the gut reliably, things like bifidobacteria, acidophilus, lactobacillus. There are probably hundreds of thousands more gut bacteria that we don't even know of. We haven't yet made their acquaintance that are really important for gut health. So one of the really fascinating areas that we're seeing now, and it has a little bit of a yuck factor for anyone who's squeamish, but is something called FMT, fecal microbiome transplants, where we actually take stool from a healthy donor and we insert it into the intestines of somebody with an infection. We're using it now for an infection called Clostridium difficile. And I think this is really the way of the future. It's not the probiotic, which a probiotic is kind of like a vitamin. You know, if you decide that tomatoes, if you do a study and you find that people who eat tomatoes are heart healthy and they have fewer heart attacks, and you say, gosh, well, tomatoes contain lycopene, so I'm going to make a vitamin with lycopene and give it to people and see if they have fewer heart attacks. That's all well and good, but there are probably 50,000 other things in the tomato that are really what are helping the heart, and so it's much better to eat a tomato. So again, pardon the yuck factor, but it's probably better to do the whole stool transfer, or even better, follow the dietary habits of the people who have a healthy microbiome.
So does that mean we should be trying to eat things that are fermented more, sauerkraut and miso and pickles and things like that? Is that where we get those good bacteria?
Yes, absolutely. So fermented pickled foods are a great source of good gut bacteria. High fiber foods, particularly foods that contain a lot of inulin, like artichokes and asparagus, are another great source. Leafy greens. So increasing those foods are great. And then the other part of that is cutting down on the foods that we know promote the growth of the wrong kind of bacteria, the undesirables. So that's a diet that's high in fat and meat, sugary, starchy, sort of processed. Unfortunately, the standard American diet. So it's not just a simple matter of going out to the pharmacy and getting a probiotic. That's not going to take you that far if you really have a depleted microbiome. You really have to change your diet. And then another huge part of that, Veronica, is avoiding probably the number one threat to your microbiome, and that's unnecessary antibiotics. We know that most of the time when you have a cold or a sinus infection, it's viral or it's a mild bacterial infection that's going to be self-limited. And so when you take antibiotics in that setting when you don't really need them, you kill off a lot of good gut bacteria that, again, can't just be replaced at the drugstore.
That's Dr. Robin Shutkin. She's the author of Gut Bliss, a 10-day plan to ban bloat, flush toxins, and dump your digestive baggage. And we spoke with her back in November. We'll have the second half of the interview coming up in a few moments. Let's go to the phones right now. We have Shandy with us in Rhinelander. Hi, Shandy.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. This is a very interesting topic to me because for the last 10 years I've struggled with gut issues.
And what have you found?
Well, 10 years ago I had a hysterectomy. I still had my ovaries, but then I developed IBS. And I tried, you know, diets and prescription medications and probiotics and all sorts of things. And we do know it's hormonally based or triggered. And what we tried just as a just to see if it would work was a low dose of antidepressants with the serotonin, and that actually has, it's not perfect, but it's much better.
Shandy, I'm so glad to hear from you, and I'm so pleased to hear you're doing better. So, you know, you raise a really important issue here with the serotonin. Serotonin is what we consider the feel-good hormone in the body, and the majority of it is located in the GI tract. So sometimes boosting serotonin levels with drugs like antidepressants can actually really help when with conditions like irritable bowel syndrome. But IBS is one of these diagnoses that I have a bit of a difficult time with because it means irritable bowel syndrome, but it doesn't tell us anything about why your bowel is irritable. And if we slice up the IBS pie, we find all kinds of things from undiagnosed celiac disease to hormonal imbalances, undiagnosed parasites, Crohn's disease, gluten intolerance. So I think when you get a diagnosis like irritable bowel, it's really important to try and pinpoint what exactly is causing the problem. And I'm so delighted that you, through lots of trial and error, were able to figure out what it is. Best of luck to you.
So it sounds like IBS is sort of an umbrella, and then from there, people need to dig deeper.
Absolutely. That's exactly right. They need to keep digging because it's sort of like if you came in to see me and you said you were really tired and I said, well, you have tired disease and here's a pill to pep you up. You know, I sort of like, well,
right.
Why am I tired? You know, is it my thyroid? Is it what's going on?
Okay. Well, thanks so much, Shandy. And we'll move on to Tom next in Delafield. Hi, Tom.
Hello there. I'd just like to add or share what happens to me on occasion. I would get the very severe gas pains, and it would, you know, pretty much bring me to my knees, and it would wrap all the way around from my back all the way through my midsection, you know, all the way around. And what my chiropractor told me about that is that there's certain vertebrae that get pinched, it, you know, it will affect the nerves going to the GI tract, and it would cause this type of gas buildup. And I'm pretty sure that he's right, because when this happens, I can kind of self-adjust this. I lay flat on the floor with a towel rolled up under my back, you know, right where I feel that the vertebrae need to be pushed back into place. And within just a matter of minutes, if I get that just the right spot and everything kind of goes back where it needs to be, I can feel the gas just dissipate, and I'm, you know, back up and running again.
Interesting. What do you make of that, Robin?
Tom, thank you, first of all, so much for sharing. And I love to hear these stories where people are, you know, being medical detectives and figuring it out. And with the help of your trusty chiropractor who came up with some really clever ideas here. And, you know, in my book, I mentioned this thing called happy abs, where people lie on their back with something heated on their belly to sort of relax the abdominal muscles and to relax the GI tract, which is also muscular structure. And then they take a very light dumbbell, like 1 or 2 pounds, and they circumnavigate the belly button in a clockwise direction to try and push air out. Yours is a little bit different because it actually has to do with your spine and the vertebrae. But again, it's just a great example of how we need to listen to our bodies and pay attention and find the right people who can help us figure out how to feel better. There's always a reason why you're bloated, why you're having digestive distress. And I really, really encourage our listeners to not just accept that this is how it is, but to roll up their sleeves and figure out why they're not feeling well and try and improve it, whether it's a food you need to eliminate, something you need to add, a massage technique you need to do, something going on with your spine. Keep searching for some answers.
All right. Thanks so much for that call, Tom. And let's go next to Pam in the Wisconsin Dells. Hey, Pam.
Hi. I just wanted to talk about I've been diagnosed with Crohn's disease about 2 years now. But my GI doctor that I have right now, he's not real sure I have Crohn's. He still thinks I have IBS. So I had one GI doctor say you have it and one who's not real sure. But they are treating me. I take Humira injections. I take methotrexate. I take a whole bunch of vitamins. And I have a gluten-free, a soy-free, no beef. Let's say I do it about 95% of the time. Beef. And I am feeling so much better.
All right. So a lot of treatments that you're giving yourself that are helping. Sounds like Pam has been a detective as well.
Absolutely.
Dr. Chuck, what about that?
I love the dietary changes, Pam. But, you know, Crohn's disease and IBS are two very different diseases. And it's really important to figure out which one it is, because while the drugs you're on are really effective, and they're drugs that I use in my practice, Humira and methotrexate, they're also pretty heavy-duty guns. I mean, methotrexate can cause liver problems, and Humira can cause, it's an immune suppressant, and it, you know, can cause, in rare circumstances, cancer. So it's really important to find out whether you have Crohn's or not. If one doctor says yes and one doctor says no, maybe a third opinion is in order, because if you cannot take those drugs, that would be fantastic. I applaud your dietary changes, and I would say keep going with that. But I think it really is very, very important to find out. Crohn's is a serious autoimmune disorder, and as a result, the drugs we use are very effective, but they have a lot of side effects. Irritable bowel, you can manage more through dietary modification and some drugs that are more benign. So really encourage you to maybe seek a third opinion and figure out whether you truly have Crohn's or not. But I'm glad you're feeling better.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Pam. Appreciate hearing your story. And Dr. Chuckin, why is it so hard to diagnose these things?
Well, you know, what's really interesting is that even today in 2013, the lag from onset of symptoms to diagnosis for Crohn's disease is 4.5 years.
Ooh,
it's really an unbelievable amount of time considering all our modern technology and all these diagnostic things we can do. But that's because the symptoms often develop before we see a lot of active inflammation in the GI tract. And then sometimes with Crohn's, the areas where we get things like ulcers and narrowing are deep within the GI tract. And the GI tract is sort of this 30-foot superhighway from the mouth to the anus. But the changes in Crohn's often occur deep in the small bowel, beyond the reach of our typical endoscopes that we use for doing colonoscopy and upper endoscopy. And, you know, I will say that there's still a real bias in the medical community when women come in to chalk it up to stress. And, you know, we see it in other fields, too. In the emergency room, woman comes in clutching her chest, what we call the classic Levine side of a heart attack, and she often gets Mylanta and gets put in a corner. Man comes in the same age with the same symptoms, clutching his chest, and he gets rushed up to the cath lab for them to check out his heart, even though heart disease is the number one killer of women. So I think there's still this bias to say that, you know, stress is a major component in women. Even the very word for uterus, hysteros, comes from the Greek, which means hysterical. So they, you know, even the ancient Greeks thought that we were a little bit dramatic. And while we know that stress is a contributor to every illness, lots of times there's something real. There's some a physiological, anatomical basis for symptoms, which brings me to one of my favorite male-female issues. And I will point out that bloating is an equal opportunity employer. Things like food and air swallowing, a condition called aerophagia that can make you go up a pant size in a day, and conditions like diverticulosis and gallbladder problems, those affect men and women. But there is a particular difference between males and females that make women more susceptible to bloating, and that's our colons. Women have a colon that, on average, is 10 centimeters longer than the male colon. And we think that's to allow for more absorption during childbirth. We also have a deeper, wider pelvis, so our colon sits really deep. It has to compete for space with our female reproductive organs, the uterus, the fallopian tubes, the ovaries. So the female colon looks like a Six Flags roller coaster, and the male colon is a nice, gentle horseshoe. And so it means in woman, the products of digestion, the gas, the air, the stool has to travel through all these twists and turns and loops and loop-de-loops and switchbacks just to come out. Women also have lower testosterone levels, and in men, higher testosterone levels mean a stronger abdominal wall that binds the bowel in place. It's like a built-in Spanx. So even when men have a bare belly, they'll complain of being fat, but often not of being bloated because of their tighter abdominal wall. So these are all things to take into consideration. Women have more undiagnosed thyroid disease, which can cause bloating, fluctuating progesterone and estrogen levels. So we have a couple advantages when it comes to bloating that actually turn out to be disadvantages.
If you could just give the people listening one tip to help with things like this, what would you tell them?
So I'm going to give you just an easy, all-natural bloating tip, and that is fennel seeds and ginger. So assuming that your bloating is not from something serious, but maybe you ate something that didn't agree with you, boil some fennel seeds and make a tea. Strain the seeds off. You can use a little honey to sweeten and make a fennel tea. Very soothing for the GI tract. Fennel is from the carrot and parsley family, has lots of medicinal qualities. Ginger chews are another great way. Now, don't overdo it with ginger candy, which has a lot of sugar in it, but you can get a little bit of caramelized ginger, and you can keep them in your purse, and ginger is another great natural bloat buster. So,
all right. Well, thank you so much for that idea, and thank you for your time today.
Thanks for having me.
And that was Dr. Robin Chutkan. She's a gastroenterologist and the author of Gut Bliss, a 10-day plan to ban bloat, flush toxins, and dump your digestive baggage. And we spoke with her back in November. Thought it might be helpful, though, coming off this busy holiday eating season, which often includes foods which might not agree with us as well as they might.